happened to his friend Ramon on the way. His hands were shaking badly as he spoke.
He took E, Dad. He's been doing E for a couple of days.
I knew about E, which was one of the latest drugs of choice around D.C., especially among high school and college kids at George Washington and Georgetown. Ramon hasn't been going to school? I asked.
No, he hasn't been going home either. He's been staying at a crib down by the river.
I knew the river area, and I headed there with a red lamp on my car roof and a siren bleeding. I had met Ramon Ramirez, and I knew about his parents. They were musicians and addicts. Ramon played baseball with Damon. He was 12. I wondered how deeply Damon was involved, but this wasn't the time for questions like that. I parked, and Damon and I walked into a dilapidated row house down near the Anacostia. The row house was 3 stories, and most of the windows were boarded. "You been in this place before?" I asked Damon.
"Yeah, I was here. I came to help Ramon. I couldn't just leave him, could I?"
"Was Ramon conscious when you left him?" I asked.
"Yeah, but his teeth were clenched together, and then he was throwing up. His nose was bleeding."
"Okay, let's see how he is. Keep up with me." We hurried down a dark hallway and turned a corner. I could smell the stench of garbage and a recent fire. Then I got a surprise. 2 EMS techs and a doctor were in a small room. They were working over a boy. I could see Ramon's black sneakers and rolled-up cargo pants. Nothing moved. The doctor rose from her kneeling position over Ramon. She was tall and heavy-set, with a pretty face. I hadn't seen her around before. I walked up to her, showed my badge, which didn't seem to impress her much. "I'm Detective Cross," I said. "How is the boy?" The woman focused hard on me.
"I'm Kayla Coles. We're working on him. I don't know yet. Someone called 911. Did you make the call?"
She looked at Damon. I realized she was the doctor Nana had talked about. Damon answered her question.
"Yes, ma'am."
"Did you take any drugs?" she asked. Damon looked at me, then at Dr. Coles.
"I don't do drugs. It's dumb."
"But your friends do? Do you have dumb friends?"
"I was trying to help him, that's all."
Dr. Coles's look was severe, but then she nodded. "You probably saved your friend's life." Damon and I waited in the bleak, foul-smelling room until we heard the news that Ramon would make it. This time. Kayla Coles stayed there the whole time. She hovered over Ramon like a guardian angel. Damon got to say a few words to Ramon before they took him to a waiting ambulance. I saw him clasp his friend's hands. It was nearly 2 in the morning when we finally made our way out of the row house. "You okay?" I asked. He nodded, but then his body started to shake, and he finally began to sob against my arm. "It's all right. It's all right," I consoled him. I put my arm around Damon's shoulder, and we headed home. Chapter 60.
Thomas Starkey, Brownlee Harris, and Warren Griffin took separate flights to New York City, all leaving out of Raleigh-Durham Airport. It was safer and a lot smarter that way, and they always worked under the assumption that they were the best after all. They couldn't make mistakes, especially now. Starkey was on the 5 o'clock out of North Carolina. He planned to meet the others at the Palisade Motel in Highland Falls, New York, just outside the United States Military Academy at West Point. There was going to be a murder there. 2 murders, actually. Then this long mission would be over. What was it Martin Sheen's commanding officer had told him in Apocalypse Now? "Remember this, Captain. There is no mission. There never was a mission." Starkey couldn't help thinking that this job had been like that for them. A long haul. Each of the murders had been complicated. This was Starkey's 4th trip to New York in the past 2 months. He still didn't even know who he was working for. He'd never met the bastard. In spite of everything, he felt confident as the Delta flight took off that evening. He talked to the flight attendant but avoided the kind of innocent flirting he might engage in under other circumstances. He didn't want to be remembered, so he stuck his face in a Tom Clancy thriller he'd picked up at the airport. Starkey identified with Clancy characters like Jack Clark and John Patrick Ryan. Once the jet leveled off and drinks were served, Starkey went over his plan for the final murders. It was all in his head, nothing was ever written down. It was in Harris's and Griffin's head, too. He hoped they didn't get into any trouble before he got to the point tonight. There was a raunchy strip club in nearby New Windsor called the Bedroom, but they'd promised they'd stay at the hotel. Finally, Starkey sat back, closed his eyes, and started doing the math again. It was a comforting ritual, especially now that they were close to the end. $100,000 apiece for the first three hits, $150,000 for the fourth, $200,000 for the fifth, $250,000 for West Point, and a $500,000 bonus when the entire job was done. It was almost over. And Starkey still didn't know who was paying for the murders, or why.
Chapter 61.
Sharp, steep cliffs of granite overlooked the Hudson River at West Point. Starkey knew the area well. Later that night, he drove down the main drag in Highland Falls, passing cheesy-looking motels, pizza shops, souvenir stands. He went through Thayer Gate with its turreted sentry tower and stone-faced MP on guard. Murder at West Point, he thought. Man, oh man. Starkey put the job out of his mind for another few moments. He let impressions of West Point wash over him. Impressions and memories. Starkey had been a cadet here, been a plebe like the two youngsters he saw jogging back to barracks now. In his day, he'd shouted the cadet motto, "Always the hard way, sir," 1,000 times if he shouted it once. God, he loved it here. The attitude, the discipline, the whole physical plant. The cadet chapel stood high on a hillside overlooking the plain. A cross between a medieval cathedral and a fortress, it still dominated the entire landscape. The campus was filled with mammoth gray stone buildings, which created a fortress effect, an overwhelming sense of solidarity and permanence. Soon to be shaken badly. Harris and Griffin were waiting for him on the grounds. For the next hour, they took turns watching the Bennett House on Bartlett Loop, an area of West Point reserved for officers and their families. The house was red brick with white trim and plenty of ivy creeping up the walls. Smoke curled lazily from the stone chimney. It was a four-bedroom, two-bath unit. On the housing map, it was designated as Quarters 130. About 9:30, the three killers reconnoitered on the 17th fairway of the West Point golf course. They didn't see anyone on the hilly course that formed one of the boundaries of the military academy. Route 9W was just to the west.
"This might be easier than we thought," Warren Griffin said. "They're both home, relaxing, guard down."
Starkey looked at Griffin disapprovingly. "I don't think so. There's a saying here, always the hard way, sir. Don't forget it. And don't forget that Robert Bennett was Special Forces. This isn't some big city architect having a sleepover on the Appalachian Trail." Griffin snapped to attention. "Sorry, sir. Won't happen again." Just before 10 o'clock, the three of them made their way through the bramble and woods that bordered the backyard of Quarters 130. Starkey pushed back a stubborn branch of a pine tree and saw the house. Then he spotted Colonel Robert Bennett in the kitchen. War hero, father of five, husband for 26 years, former Special Forces in Vietnam. Bennett was holding a goblet of red wine and seemed to be supervising the preparation of a meal. Barbara Bennett stepped into view. She was doing the real work. Now she, too, took a sip of his wine. Robert Bennett kissed the back of her neck. "They seem loving for a couple married well over 20 years. "That's too bad," Starkey thought, but kept it to himself.
"Let's do it," he said. "The last piece in the puzzle."
And it truly was a puzzle, even to the killers.
Chapter 62.
Robert and Barbara Bennett were just sitting down to dinner when the three heavily armed men burst through the back door into the kitchen. Colonel Bennett saw their guns and camouflage dress, also noting that none of the men were wearing masks. He saw all of the faces, and knew this couldn't be worse.
"Who are you? Robert? Who are they?" Barbara sputtered out a few words. "What's the meaning of this?"
Unfortunately, Colonel Bennett was afraid that he knew exactly who they were, and maybe even who had sent them. He wasn't sure, but he thought he recognized one of them from a long time ago. He even remembered a name. Starkey. Yes, Thomas Starkey. Good God, why now, after all these years? One of the intruders pulled shut the colorful curtains on the two kitchen windows. He used a free arm to sweep the dinner plates, chicken, salad, and wine glasses crashing onto the kitchen floor. Bennett understood this was for dramatic effect. Another man held an automatic weapon pressed to Barbara Bennett's forehead. The kitchen was totally silent. Colonel Bennett looked at his wife, and his heart nearly broke. Her blue eyes were stretched wide, and she was trembling. "It's going to be all right," Bennett said in the calmest voice he could manage.
"Oh, is it, Colonel?"
Starkey spoke for the first time. He signaled the third intruder, and the man grabbed the front of Barbara's white peasant blouse and tore it off. Barbara gasped and tried to cover herself. The bastard then yanked off her bra. It was for effect, of course. But then the man stared at Barbara's breasts.
"Leave her alone! Don't hurt her!"
Bennett yelled, and it sounded like a command, as if he were in a position to give one. The man he knew to be Starkey hit him with the butt of his handgun. Bennett went down and thought that his jaw was broken. He almost blacked out, but managed to stay conscious. His cheek was pressed into the cold tile of the kitchen floor. He needed a plan. Even a desperate one would do. Starkey stood directly over him, and now it got insane. He spoke in Vietnamese. Colonel Bennett understood some of the words. He'd done enough interrogations during the war when he'd run several Kit Carson scouts in Vietnam and Laos. Then Starkey spoke in English.
"Be afraid, Colonel. You'll suffer tonight. So will your wife. You have sins to pay for. You know what they are. Tonight your wife will know about your past, too."
Colonel Bennett pretended to pass out. When one of the gunmen leaned over him, he pushed off the floor and grabbed at the handgun. Getting the gun was the only thought in Bennett's brain. He had it. But then he was struck viciously on the head, then on the shoulders and back. He was being screamed at in Vietnamese as the severe beating continued. He saw one of the bastards punch his wife right in the face, for no reason at all.
"Stop it! Don't hurt her, for Christ's sake!" "Mai se nhìn, cô ấy chết,"
Starkey yelled in Vietnamese. "Now you get to watch her die.
Trong lúc tao hỏi mày,
while I interrogate you, pig.
Mai tai kang, nai co quen kong, Robert."
Does that sound familiar, Robert? Starkey then forced his pistol inside Colonel Bennett's mouth.
"Remember this, Colonel? Remember what happens next?"
Chapter 63. Samson and I got to West Point a little after 5 o'clock on Thursday evening. All hell had broken loose there. I'd received an urgent heads-up from Ron Burns at the FBI. There'd been a murder-suicide at the point that had immediately aroused suspicions when the news got to Washington. A highly decorated colonel had supposedly killed his wife, then himself. Samson and I flew into Stewart Airport in Newburgh. Then I drove 18 miles to West Point. We had to park our rented car and walk the last several blocks to the officers' housing. The streets were roped off and closed to through traffic. The press was on hand, but they were being kept away by military police. Even the cadets couldn't help looking curious and concerned. "You're getting chummy with Burns and the FBI," Samson said, as we walked to the murder scene on Bartlett Loop. "He's given a lot of help. He has it in his head that I might want to work with them," I told Samson. "And? Might you?" I smiled at Samson, didn't confirm or deny. "I thought you were getting out of police work, sugar. Wasn't that the big master plan?" "I don't know anything for sure right now. Here I am, though, headed to another completely fucked up murder scene with you. Same shit, different day. So, you're still hooked, Alex. Bad as ever, right?" I shook my head. "No, I'm not hooked on the case, John. I'm helping you out.
Remember how this started? Payback for Ellis Cooper? Yeah, and you're also hooked. You can't figure out this puzzle. That makes you angry. And curious as hell. That's who you are, Alex. You're a hunter.
I am what I am.
I shook my head and finally smiled.
Said Popeye the Sailor Man.
Chapter 64. The Bennett house was roped off and secured. Samson and I identified ourselves to a nervous-looking MP at the perimeter of the crime scene. I could tell that he'd never seen anything like this before. Unfortunately, I had. After we put on disposable paper boots, we were permitted to climb 3 stone steps that led into the house. Then we went looking for a CID officer named Pat Conti. The Army was cooperating because of the other cases. They'd also let in a couple of FBI techies to show their good faith. I found Captain Conti in the narrow hallway leading from the living room. The murders had apparently taken place in the kitchen. Techies were dusting for fingerprints and photographing the scene from every angle. Conti shook hands and then told us what he knew, or thought that he knew at this point.
All I can give you so far is the obvious. From the looks of things, Colonel Bennett and his wife were engaged in an argument that seems to have turned violent. For a while, she must have given as good as she got. Then Bennett retrieved his service revolver. He shot her in the temple. Then Colonel Bennett shot himself. Friends say that he and his wife were close, but that they fought a lot, sometimes violently. As you can see, the shooting took place in the kitchen, sometime last night.
That's what you think happened? I asked Conti.
At this point, that's my statement.
I shook my head and felt my anger rising. I was told that because of the possible connection of these deaths with the others that we could expect cooperation here. Captain Conti nodded.
That's what you just got. My full cooperation. Excuse me, I have work here.
He walked away. Samson shrugged as we watched the CID officer shuffle off.
Can't say that I blame him too much. I wouldn't want you and me messing around at my crime scene either.
So, let's go mess around. I went over to see if I could get anything from the FBI people, the Evidence Response Team, also known as ERTs. They were being their usual thorough selves in the kitchen. Given the normal amount of dislike for the FBI, it's remarkable how much respect is given to ERTs. The reason is, they're very, very good. 2 members of the ERT were taking Polaroid shots in the kitchen. Another, wearing a white coverall called a bunny suit, was looking for fibers and hairs using an alternative light source. Everybody had on rubber gloves and paper booties over their shoes. The head man was named Michael Fesco. I had already met him down on the Appalachian Trail, where he had supervised the crime scene investigation in the woods. CID giving you their full cooperation too? I asked. He scratched his light brown crew cut.
I can tell you my version, and it's a little different from Captain Conti's.
Please, I said. Fesco began. The killers, whoever they were, did a thorough job with both the setup and the cleanup. They've done this before. They're professionals through and through, just like the killers in West Virginia.
How many of them? I asked.
Fesco held up 3 fingers.
3 men. They surprised the Bennetts at dinner. And then they murdered them. These men, they bring force to bear without conscience. You can quote me on that.
Chapter 65.
It was time to celebrate. The war was over. Starkey, Harris, and Griffin ordered obscenely large, very rare porterhouse steaks topped with jumbo shrimp at Sparks Restaurant on East 46th Street in Manhattan. For anyone with wads of the green stuff, there was no better place to get happy in a hurry than New York City. 3 years, but it's finally over, said Harris, raising a glass of cognac, his 4th after-dinner drink of the evening. Unless our mysterious benefactor changes his mind, cautioned Starkey. It could happen. 1 more hit, or maybe a complication that we didn't plan on. Which doesn't mean we shouldn't party tonight. Brownlee Harris finished his cheesecake and dabbed his mouth with a cloth napkin. Tomorrow we go home to Rocky Mount, the good life.
That's not so terrible bad. We're finally out of the game, undefeated and unscored upon. Nobody can touch us now. Warren Griffin just grinned. He was pretty well plowed. So was Harris. But not Starkey, who said, "But tonight we party. We damn well deserve it. Just like the old days, Saigon and Bangkok, Hong Kong. The night is young and we're full of mischief. Piss and vinegar." He leaned in close to his friends. "I want to rape and pillage tonight. It's our right." After they left the restaurant, the three friends strolled to East 52nd between First and York. The brownstone they stopped at was a walk-up that had seen better days. 4 stories, no doorman. Starkey knew it as Asia House. He rang the front buzzer and waited for the intercom. He had been here before. A woman answered in a sultry voice. "Hi, may I have your cold, please, gentlemen?" Starkey gave it in Vietnamese. "Silver Mercedes 11. They were buzzed inside.
"Kak em dam cho? Em de pet sai?"
the female said in Vietnamese. "The ladies are waiting, and they are stunning." "So are we," Thomas Starkey said and laughed. Starkey, Harris, and Griffin climbed the flight of red-carpeted stairs. As they reached the first landing, a plain gray door opened. An Asian girl, slender and young, no more than 18 and gorgeous, stood legs akimbo in the doorway. She had on a black bra and matching panties, thigh-high stockings, slingbacks with high heels.
"Hi there," she said in English. "I'm Kim. Welcome, you're very good-looking men. This will be fun for us, too."
"You're very beautiful, too, Kim," Starkey said in Vietnamese, "and your English is flawless." He then pulled out a revolver and pointed it between the girl's eyes. "Don't say another word or you die. Right here, right now, Kim. Your blood all over the carpet and those walls." He shoved the girl into a living room where 3 other girls were seated on 2 small couches. They were also young, Asian, very pretty. They wore silk negligees, lavender, red, and pink, with color-coordinated high heels and stockings, Victoria's Secret.
"Don't speak, ladies. Not a word," Starkey said, pointing his gun at one, then another.
"Shh."
Brownlee Harris held a finger to his lips.
"Nobody gets hurt. We don't want that either. Trust me, my little Asian dolls."
Starkey threw open the door at the rear of the living room. He surprised an older woman, probably the voice over the intercom, as well as a husky bouncer in a black t-shirt and gym shorts that had "Crunch" stenciled on it. They were greedily eating Chinese food out of cardboard containers.
"Nobody gets hurt," Starkey said in Vietnamese as he shut the door behind him. "Hands up high."
The man and woman slowly raised their hands, and Starkey shot them dead with the silenced revolver. He wandered over to some high-tech equipment and calmly removed a tape. The surveillance camera at the front entrance had recorded their arrival, of course. Starkey left the slumped, bloody bodies and returned to the living room. The party had begun without him. Brownlee Harris was kissing and fondling the pretty young girl who had answered the door. He had lifted Kim up and held her tiny mouth pressed against his. She was too frightened to resist.
"Ma kai nai, moi dem lai niu kinyem,"
Starkey said, and smiled at his friends, but also at the women. Memories are made of this.
Chapter 66.
They had done this many times before, and not just in New York. They'd celebrated victories in Hong Kong, Saigon, Frankfurt, Los Angeles, even London. It had all started in South Vietnam when they were just boys in their teens and early 20s. When the war was on and the madness was everywhere around them. Starkey called it bloodlust. The 4 Asian girls were terrified, and that was the thrill for Starkey. He totally got off on the look of fear in their eyes. Starkey believed that all men did, though few would admit it.
"Bong dao, mong ma di gang mong,"
he shouted. "We want to party now."
"Ke mau tik ang mong te toi."
"It's a celebration." Starkey found out the girls' names. Kim, Lan,
Susie, and Hua. They were pretty, but Kim was truly beautiful. A slender body with small breasts, delicate features, the best of a complicated heritage that could be Chinese, French, and Indian. Harris found bottles of scotch and champagne in a small kitchen. He passed the hooch around and made the girls drink too. The alcohol calmed them, but Kim kept asking about the owner. Occasionally the bell rang downstairs. Kim's English was the best, so she was told to say that the girls were busy for the night, a private party.
Come back another time, please. Thank you.
Griffin took two of the girls upstairs to another floor. Starkey and Harris looked at each other and rolled their eyes. Starkey kept an ear cocked once Griffin was upstairs. At least he'd left two pretty ones for Brownlee and him, Kim and Lan. Starkey asked Kim to dance. Her eyes were gleaming slants of dark purple. Except for her 3-inch heels, Kim was naked now. An old song by the Yardbirds played on the radio. As he danced, Starkey remembered that Vietnamese women had a thing about their height, at least when they were around American men. Or maybe it was American men who had a thing about height. Or length. Harris was speaking in English to Lan. He handed her a bottle of champagne. Drink, he said. No, drink it down there, babe. The girl understood, either the words or lewd gestures. She shrugged, then dropped onto the couch and inserted the champagne bottle in herself. She poured the champagne, then comically wiped her lips.
I was thirsty, she said in English.
The joke got a good laugh, broke the tension.
An kung fai ung nua, the girl said. You drink too.
Harris laughed and passed the bottle to Kim. She lifted one leg and put it inside without sitting down. She kept it there while she danced with Starkey, spilling champagne all over the carpet and her shoes. Everybody was laughing now.
The bubbles tickle, Kim said, sitting down on the couch. I have a itch inside me now. You want to scratch it? She asked Starkey.
The switchblade seemed to come from nowhere. Kim jabbed it at Starkey without actually stabbing him. She screamed,
You go! Leave right now or I cut you bad!
Then Starkey had his gun out. He was cool and calm. He reached over to the radio and shut off the loud music. Silence. And dread. Incredible tension in the room. Everywhere except on Thomas Starkey's face.
Dung, Sin Dung, cried Kim. Hai Dep Sung, Hong Sang Mo Ten Di Bo.
No, no, put the gun away. Starkey moved toward little Kim. He wasn't afraid of the switchblade, almost as if he knew he wasn't going to die like this. He twisted the knife out of her hand, then held the revolver against the side of her skull. Tears ran down the girl's smooth cheeks. Starkey brushed them away. She smiled up at him.
Hai Lam Tin, Voi Em Di, Ang Lin,
she whispered. Make love to me, soldier man. Starkey was there in the apartment, but his head was in Vietnam. Kim was shaking and he loved that. The total control he felt, the evil he was capable of, the electricity it could bring into his system. He looked at Harris, who had his gun out now too, and his friend knew, he just knew. They fired their guns simultaneously. The girls flew back against the wall and then slid down onto the floor. Kim was shaking all over, very close to death.
Why?
She whispered. Starkey just shrugged at her. Upstairs there were two more pfts, the sound of falling bodies, Susie and Hua. Warren Griffin had been waiting for them. He knew, too. It was just like in the An Lao Valley, Vietnam, where the madness had started.
Chapter 67 When we finished up at Colonel Bennett's house, Samson and I checked into the Hotel Thayer right on the grounds of West Point. I continued to think about the three killers and how they kept getting away. There was no blue paint this time. And none of the other victims had been set up to look like suicides, but it still felt the same. Forced to bear without conscience. That was what Agent Fesco had called it. In the morning, I met Samson for breakfast in the hotel dining room overlooking the majestic Hudson, which appeared almost steely gray in the distance and was topped by whitecaps. We talked about the Grizzly Bennett murders and wondered whether they were connected to the others, whether the killers had changed their pattern.
Or maybe there are more murders that we just don't know about, Samson said. Who knows how many have been killed at this point, or how far back the murders go?
Samson poured himself another steaming cup of coffee.
It has to come down to the three killers. They were here, Alex. It has to be the same three men.
I couldn't disagree with him. I have to make a few calls, then we're out of here. I want to make sure the local police are checking into whether anybody actually saw three men who don't belong on the grounds or in Highland Falls.
I went upstairs to my room and called Director Burns. He wasn't in, so I left a message. I wanted to call Jamila, but it was too early in California, so I logged onto my computer and left her a long email. Then I saw that I had a message. Now what? It turned out to be from Janny and Damon. They were busting my chops about being away from home again, even for a night. When was I coming back? Would they get a neat souvenir from West Point? How about a shiny new sword for each of them? And one for little Alex, too. There was a second message for me. It wasn't from the kids. Or Jamila.
Detective Cross, while you were at West Point, you ought to see Colonel Owen Handler. He teaches political science. He might have some answers for you. He's a friend of the Bennetts. He might even know who killed them. I'm just trying to be helpful. You need all the help you can get. Foot Soldier.
Chapter 68. The three killers had been right here. I couldn't get the thought out of my head, but the feeling was in my bones, my blood. Samson and I walked along the main drag toward Thayer Hall. Several cadets were out parade drilling on the plain. As we got closer, I saw that wooden pegs were driven into the ground to show the cadets exactly where to turn their faultlessly sharp corners. I had to smile. It reminded me that so many things in life were an illusion. Maybe even the facts I was collecting on this case.
So, what do you think about this help we're getting? The mad emailer? Foot soldier? Samson asked.
I don't like it, Alex. It's too convenient, too pat. This whole case is about being set up.
You're right. We don't have any reason to trust the information we're getting, so I don't. On the other hand, we're here. Why not talk to Professor Handler? It can't hurt.
Samson shook his head. I wish that was so, Alex.
I had called the history department immediately after I received the helpful email from Foot Soldier. I was told that Professor Handler had a class that met from 11 until noon. We had 20 minutes to kill, so we took in a few sights. Washington Hall, a cavernous three-story building where the entire corps of cadets could sit simultaneously for meals. The Eisenhower and MacArthur Barracks, the cadet chapel, plus several incomparable river vistas. Cadets flowed past us lickety-split on the sidewalk. They wore long-sleeved gray shirts with black ties, gray trousers with a black stripe, brass belt buckles shined to perfection. Everybody was moving in double time. It was contagious. Thayer Hall was a huge gray building that was virtually windowless. Inside, the classrooms all looked identical, each with desks arranged in a horseshoe so that everyone was in the front row. Samson and I waited in a deserted hallway until Handler's class was finished and the cadets filed out. They were incredibly orderly for college students, which didn't surprise me, but it was still impressive to watch. Why aren't students in all universities orderly? Because no one demands it? Well, hell, who cares? But it was a striking, impressive scene. All these young kids with so much purpose and resolve. On the surface, anyway. Professor Handler trailed his students out of the classroom. He was a burly man, about 6'1", with short-cropped salt and pepper hair. I already knew he'd served two tours of duty in Vietnam and had an M.A. from the University of Virginia and a doctorate from Penn State. That much was on the West Point website. We're Detectives Cross and Samson, I said as I walked up to him. Could we talk to you for a moment? Handler grimaced.
What's this about, detectives? One of our cadets in trouble?
No, I shook my head. The cadets seem beyond reproach. A smile broke across Handler's face.
Oh, you'd be surprised.
They only look blameless, Detective. So, if it isn't one of our charges, what is it you'd like to talk to me about? Robert and Barbara Bennett? I've already spoken to Captain Conti. I thought CID was handling that. They are, I told him. But the murders might be a little more complicated than they appear. Just like the cadets here at West Point. As concisely as I could, I told Handler about the other murder cases that Samson and I had been investigating. I didn't tell him about the email from Foot Soldier that had led us to him. As I spoke, I noticed a professor in the classroom next to Handler's. He had a bucket of water and a sponge, and he was actually washing the blackboard before the next class. All the classrooms had identical buckets and sponges. Hell of a system. We think there's a connection to something pretty bad that took place in Vietnam, I said to Professor Handler. Maybe the murders actually started there. I served in Southeast Asia. 2 tours, Handler volunteered. Vietnam and Cambodia. So did I, said Samson. 2 tours. Suddenly, and for no apparent reason, Colonel Handler seemed nervous. His eyes narrowed and darted around the hallway. The cadets were gone now, no doubt rushing off to Washington Hall for lunch. I'll talk to you, he finally said, but not on the grounds. Pick me up at my place tonight. It's quarters 98. We'll go someplace else. Come by at 8 sharp. He looked at Samson and me, and then Professor Handler turned and walked away. In double time. Chapter 69. I had the feeling that we were close to something important at West Point, and maybe with Colonel Handler. It was something indefinable that I'd seen in his eyes when the subject had turned to Vietnam. Maybe the murders started there. The colonel had made reservations at what he called an extraordinarily misplaced northern Italian restaurant in Newburgh, Il Cenacolo. We were on our way there, riding the Storm King Highway, a winding roller coaster with incredible views of the Hudson, which stretched out hundreds of feet below. Why didn't you want to talk to us closer to home? I finally asked the colonel. 2 of my best friends were just murdered there, Handler said. He lit up a cigarette and blew out a stream of smoke. It was pitch black outside, and the mountainous road had no lights to guide our way. You believe the Bennetts were murdered? I asked. I know they were. Do you know why? I might. You've heard of the blue wall of silence with the police. In the army, it's the same, only the wall is gray. It's higher, thicker, and has been here for a hell of a long time. I had to ask another question. I couldn't hold back. Are you Foot Soldier, Colonel? If you are, we need your help. Handler didn't seem to understand. What the hell is Foot Soldier? What are you talking about? I told him that a mysterious someone had been periodically slipping me information, including his name. Maybe you thought it was time we met face to face, I said. No, I may be a source for you now, but it's only because of Bob and Barbara Bennett. I'm not Foot Soldier. I never contacted you. You came to see me, remember? As convincing as he sounded, I didn't know whether to believe him, but I had to pursue the identity of Foot Soldier. I asked Handler for names, others who might be helpful in the investigation. He gave me a few, some Americans, even a couple of South Vietnamese who might be willing to help. Handler spoke from the darkened back seat of the sedan. I don't know who's been contacting you, but I'm not so sure that I'd trust whoever it was. Right about now, I'm not sure I'd trust anyone. Not even you, Colonel? Especially not me, he said, and laughed. Hell, I'm a college professor. I glanced up into the rearview mirror and saw a single pair of headlights approaching. I hadn't noticed much traffic so far, and most of it had been speeding in the opposite direction, heading south. Suddenly, Samson raised his voice and turned to Handler. Why don't you tell us what's really going on, Colonel? How many more have to die? What do you know about these murders? That's when I heard a gunshot and the sound of glass shattering. The car from behind was already on us. My eyes darted and I saw a driver, then a gunman leaning out of the window of the back seat. Get down! I yelled at Handler and Samson. Cover up! More shots came from the pursuing car. I violently swerved the wheel to the left. We skidded hard across double yellow lines, headed for the mountain. Handler yelled, Watch it, Jesus, watch it! We hit a straight part of the highway, thank God. I stomped on the accelerator, picking up some speed, but I couldn't lose the other car. He was still in the right-hand lane, but I was in the wrong lane, the one meant for oncoming traffic. Samson had gotten to his gun and had returned fire. More shots struck our car. The other sedan stayed right with us. I couldn't shake loose. I was doing over 90 on a twisty road built for 50 or 60. On my left side was a shoulder and then the mountain wall. On my right, across the other lane, a sheer drop down toward the Hudson River and certain death. I was going too fast to see faces in the other car. Who the hell was it? Suddenly, I stomped on the brakes and our car skidded badly. Then it fishtailed. We wound up facing the opposite direction, south. I took off that way, back toward West Point. I floored it again, got back up to 90 in an awful hurry. I passed two cars heading north, both blaring their horn at me. I couldn't blame them. I was over the double line and racing about 40 miles per hour over the speed limit. They must have thought I was drunk or mad or both. When I was sure no one was following, I slowed down. "Handler? Colonel?" I called out. He didn't answer. Samson hung over the back seat to check on him. "He's been hit, Alex." I pulled over to the side of the road and turned on the interior light. "How bad? Is he alive?" I saw that Handler had been shot twice. Once in the shoulder, and once in the side of the head. "He's dead," Samson said. "He's gone." "You all right?" I asked. "Yeah," he said. "I wasn't the target, and that boy in the car could shoot. He was after Handler. We just lost our first real lead." I wondered if we had lost Foot Soldier as well. Chapter 70. There's nothing like an attempt on your life to get you properly focused, and also to get the blood boiling. It was an exercise in futility, but Samson and I rushed Owen Handler to the ER at the West Point Hospital. He was pronounced dead at about 9. I'm certain he was dead when we brought him in. The shooter in the other car was a chillingly good marksman, a professional killer. Had 3 men actually been in the pursuing car? We were questioned by the local police and also CID officers from West Point. Captain Conti even came to see us, spouting his concern for our safety, but also playing 20 questions with us, almost as if we were suspects. Conti informed me that the commanding officer at West Point, General Mark Hutchinson, was personally supervising the investigation now, whatever that was supposed to mean. Then General Hutchinson actually showed up at the hospital. I saw him speaking to Captain Conti, then a few other grim-faced officers gathered in the hallway. But Hutchinson never came over to see Samson and me. Not a word of condolence or concern. How goddamn strange and inconsiderate. It was maddening. The gray wall of silence, I thought, remembering Owen Handler's words. General Mark Hutchinson left the hospital without even making contact with us. I wasn't going to forget that. All the while I was at the West Point Hospital, I couldn't get one thought out of my head. There is nothing like an attempt on your life to get your blood boiling. I was shaken by the attack on Colonel Handler, but I was also angry as hell. Wasn't that part of the motive behind the massacre at My Lai and others like it? Anger, fear, the need for retribution? Unthinkable things happened during combat. Tragedies were inevitable. They always had been. What was the army trying to cover up now? Who had sent the killers after us tonight? Who had murdered Colonel Handler and why? Samson and I spent the night at the Hotel Thayer again. General Hutchinson decided to put MPs on the second floor to protect us. I didn't think it was necessary. If the gunmen had been after us, they wouldn't have driven off and left us alive. I kept thinking. 2 men had been in the car that attacked us. There had been 3 men involved in the earlier Fort Bragg and West Point killings. I couldn't get the fact out of my head either. 3, not 2. Finally, I called Jamila and shared with her everything that had happened. Detective to detective, friend to friend. She didn't like the actions of General Hutchinson and the Army either. Just talking it through with her helped tremendously. I was thinking about doing it more often, like maybe every night. I finally fell asleep on that thought.
Chapter 71. The following morning, the New York papers were filled with a story about the murder of four call girls, a madam, and a bouncer on the East Side. The women were Vietnamese and Thai, and because of that, I talked to the detective in charge of the investigation in Manhattan. So far, the NYPD was nowhere on the grisly case. I thought about going to New York, but there were other things pressing on my mind. There was an important lead I hadn't even begun to satisfactorily check out. Foot Soldier. Who the hell was he? Or she? And why had Foot Soldier contacted me by email? What was the mystery person trying to tell me? Owen Handler had given me a few names, and I had Ron Burns track a few of them down. The most interesting to me was Tran Van Lo, a former ARVN scout who was now living in the United States. There was a catch, a big one. Tran Van Lo was on death row in Florence, Colorado. He'd been found guilty of murdering 9 people in Newark and New York City. I knew a little about the federal prison at Florence and had even been there once. That was the second catch. Kyle Craig was imprisoned there, my old nemesis. Kyle was also on death row. The Florence ADX was one of the so-called Supermax prison facilities. 36 states now had them. Death row was located in the security housing unit, a kind of prison within a prison. It turned out to be a bland, sand-colored building with extraordinarily heavy security inside and out. That was comforting, since Kyle Craig was being held inside, and Kyle had nothing but disdain for prison security. 2 heavily armed guards accompanied me to death row. As we walked down the otherwise empty, fluorescent-lit hallways, I heard none of the usual chaotic noise of a prison. My mind was somewhere else, anyway. I had arrived in Colorado about noon. Everything was running smoothly on the home front, and hopefully I'd be back in D.C. that night. Nana wasn't missing any opportunities, though. Before I left the house, she sat me down and told me one of her story parables. She called it The Story of the Thousand Marbles. "I heard this on NPR, Alex. It's a true story, and I'm passing it along to you for what it's worth. Seems there was this man who lived in Southern California, around San Diego, I believe it was. He had a family, nice family, and he worked very hard, long hours, lots of weekends. Sound familiar?" "Probably familiar to a lot of people," I said. "Men and women. Go ahead, though, Nana. This hard-working man with the extraordinarily nice family living outside San Diego. What happened to him?" "Well, anyway, this man had a kindly grandfather who adored both him and his family. He'd noticed that his grandson was working too hard, and he was the one who told him about the marbles. He told it this way. He said that the average lifespan for men was around 75 years. That meant 3,900 Saturdays, to play when you were a kid and to be with your family when you got older and wiser." "I see," I said. "Or to play once you got older, or even to give lectures to anyone who'll listen." "Shush, Alex. Now listen." "So the grandfather figured out that his grandson, who was 43, had about 1,660 Saturdays left in his life, statistically speaking. So what he did was he bought 2 large jars and filled them with beautiful cat's eye marbles. He gave them to his grandson, and he told him that every Saturday he should take 1 marble out of the jar, just 1, and just as a reminder that he had only so many Saturdays left, and that they were precious beyond belief. Think about that, Alex, if you have the time," said Nana. So here I was at a Supermax prison on a Saturday. I didn't think I was wasting the day, not at all. But Nana's message had sunk in anyway. This was my last murder case. It had to be. This was the end of the road for Detective Alex Cross. I focused my mind on the baffling case as I walked toward the cell of Tran Van Lo. He would make my trip worth at least 1 marble. Or so I had to hope. Chapter 72. Tran Van Lo was 54 years old, and he informed me that he spoke Vietnamese, French, and English fluently. His English was excellent,
and I couldn't help thinking that he looked more like a college professor than a prison inmate convicted of several murders. Lo wore gold wire-rimmed glasses and had a long gray goatee. He was philosophical, about everything, apparently. But was he foot soldier?
"Nominally, I am a Buddhist,"
he said, as he sat in a cell that was only 7 by 12 feet. A bed, a stool, and a fixed writing shelf filled more than half of the space. The fixtures were all made of poured concrete, so they couldn't be moved or disassembled by the inmates.
"I will give you some history. The backstory."
I nodded. That would be a good place to start.
"My birthplace is Son Trac Village in the Quang province, just north of what was the DMZ. This is one of the country's poorest provinces, but they are all relatively poor. I started work in my family's rice fields at 5. Everyone was always hungry, even though we grew food. We had one real meal a day, usually yams or cassava. Ironically, our rice was handed over to the landlord. All loyalty was to the family, including ancestors, a plot of land, and the village. Nationalism was non-existent, a Western notion imported by Ho Chi Minh. My family moved south in 1963 and I enlisted in the army. The alternative was starvation, and besides, I had been brought up to hate the communists. I proved to be an excellent scout and was recommended to McVie Rakondo School run by U.S. Army Special Forces. This was my initial encounter with Americans. I liked them at first.
What happened to change that? I asked Lo.
Many things. Mostly, I came to understand that many of the Americans looked down on me and my countrymen. Despite repeated promises, I was left behind in Saigon. I became a boat person. I finally got to America in 79, Orange County in California, which has a very large Vietnamese population. The only way we could survive was to recreate the family village structure from our own country. I did so with a gang, the Ghost Shadows. We became successful at first in California, then in the New York area, including Newark. They say I murdered members of rival gangs in New York and Jersey.
Did you? I asked Lo.
Oh, of course. It was justifiable, though. We were in a war.
He stopped talking, stared at me. So now you're here in a supermax prison. Have you received a date for the execution?
No, which is very humorous to me. Your country is afraid to execute convicted murderers.
It's comical, because of things you saw in Vietnam?
Of course. That is my frame of reference.
Atrocities committed in the name of military activity.
It was war, detective.
Did you know any of these men in Vietnam? Ellis Cooper, Reese Tate, James Etra, Robert Bennett, Lawrence Houston? Lo shrugged.
It was a long time ago, over 30 years, and there are so many American surnames to remember.
Colonel Owen Handler?
I don't know him.
I think you do. Actually, Colonel Handler was in charge of the McVie Rakondo School when you were there being trained as a scout. Lo smiled for the first time.
Believe it or not, Detective Cross, the scouts didn't usually get to meet the man in charge.
But you met Colonel Handler. He remembered you to the day he was killed. Can you help me stop the murders? I asked Lo. You know what happened over there, don't you? Why did you agree to see me? He gave another indifferent shrug.
I agreed to see you because my good friend asked me to. My friend is Kyle Craig.
Chapter 73. I could feel a cold spot where my heart was supposed to be. This couldn't all be leading to Kyle Craig. I had put him here in Florence for all the murders he had committed, and now, somehow, he'd gotten me to come and visit.
Hello, Alex. I thought you'd forgotten all about me,
Kyle said when he saw me. We met in a small interview room near his cell block. My head was full of paranoid thoughts about the coincidence of seeing him again. He couldn't have set this up. Not even he could do that. Kyle had changed physically,
so much so that he resembled one of his older brothers, or maybe his father, more than his previous self. When I had been pursuing him, I'd met everyone in Kyle's family. He'd always been gaunt, but in prison he had lost at least 20 pounds. His head was shaved and he had a tattoo on one side of his skull. It was part dragon, part snake. He actually looked like a killer now.
Sit down, Alex. I missed you even more than I thought I would. Sit, please, let's talk the talk. Catch up with the catch-up.
I'll stand, thanks. I'm not here to make small talk, Kyle. What do you know about these murders?
They've all been solved by the police or the army, Alex. The guilty have been charged and in some cases executed. Just as I will be eventually. Why waste your time on them? I'm 100 times more interesting. You should be studying me.
His words were delivered in a low-key manner, but they went through me like a powerful electric current. Was Kyle the missing goddamn connection? He couldn't be behind the murders. They had started long before he'd been arrested. But did that really matter? So you don't know anything that can help me? Then I'm leaving. Have a nice life. Kyle raised a hand.
I'd like to help, Alex. I mean that sincerely. Just like the old days. I miss it. The chase. What if I could help?
If you can, then do it, Kyle. Do it right now. We'll see where it goes from there. Kyle leaned back in his chair. Finally, he smiled. Or maybe he was laughing at me?
Well, since you didn't ask, it's better here in prison than I could have hoped. Believe it or not, I'm a minor celebrity. And not just among my peers. Even the kick-ass guards cater to my wishes. I have lots of visitors. I'm writing a book, Alex. And of course, I'm figuring out some way to get out of here. Trust me, I will someday. It's just a matter of time. It almost happened a month ago. This close. I would have come to visit, of course. You and Nana and those sweet children.
Does Lo know anything?
Oh, absolutely. He's very well read. Speaks 3 languages fluently. I like Lou very much. We're dear friends. I also like Ted Kaczynski, Yu Kikimura, the Japanese terrorist, and Ramon Mata, formerly with the Medellin cartel. Interesting inmates, fascinating lives, though more conservative than I would have expected. Not Ted, but the others.
I'd had enough. Of Kyle Craig, Lo, Florence. I'm going, I said. I started to walk away.
You'll be back. Maybe I'll come and visit you next time. At any rate, best of luck with your fascinating murder case.
I turned back. You'll be in here for the rest of your life. Not too long, I hope. Kyle Craig laughed heartily in his cell. More than ever, he gave me the creeps. Chapter 74. As John Sampson drove into Bayhead, New Jersey, he felt his spirits rise dramatically, and the very pleasant sensation inside made him smile to himself. He was doing a lot of that lately. Hell, he was going to ruin his tough guy image if he kept this shit up much longer. He drove along Route 35, past sprawling beach houses, Central Market, and a couple of picturesque, whitewashed churches. This part of the Jersey Shore was quiet and undeniably pretty. He couldn't help but appreciate the serenity and the well-preserved beauty. A slight breeze from the ocean blew through the open windows of his Cougar. Geraniums and rose hips bloomed along the side of the road, obviously planted by the village itself. What was not to like? He was glad to be here again. Long ways from D.C., he found himself thinking. And it's not all bad, for a change of pace anyway, for a break from all the murders. During the drive up from D.C., Sampson had tried to convince himself that this excursion to the Jersey Shore was all about Ellis Cooper and the other murders, but that wasn't the whole truth. Coop was definitely a big part of it, but this was also about Billy Houston. He thought about her all the time. What was it about that wisp of a woman? Actually, he knew at least part of the answer. From the moment he'd met her, he was completely comfortable. She was the female friend he'd been hoping to meet for a long time. It was hard to describe the feeling, but he knew he'd never had it before. He felt that he could tell Billy things about himself that he'd held inside for a long time. He trusted her already. When he was with her, he could come outside of himself, leave the castle he had constructed to guard the person he really was from being hurt. On the other hand, John Sampson had never had a successful long-term relationship with any woman. Never been married, not even seriously tempted. So he wasn't going to delude himself or get too soppy and